It's a big place, but Spain has set up a modern rail network that can get you quickly into nearly all corners of that country. Coming up, guides from Spain tip us off on how to enjoy traveling on the Spanish rail system.
There's just something really magical about watching the Spanish countryside going by while you're having a glass of Rioja.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof started out reporting from a number of hotspots around the world. He tells us what it takes to work as a foreign correspondent in the world's conflict zones.
Security is something I take very seriously, partly because I've lost too many friends along the way.
And lately, British journalist John Elledge has been examining the often surprising stories behind today's national borders.
They weren't necessarily the hard lines we imagine them to be now. They were more likely to be sort of fuzzy no-man's lands where imperial control gradually peters out.
It's all just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Come along. The lines on a map can change the lives of the people who live on either side of them. Coming up today on Travel with Rick Steves, we examine how colonial-era border drawing by European politicians came with lasting consequences. And Nicholas Kristof tells us what it was like to report from overseas conflict zones where your job as a foreign correspondent includes just managing to stay alive. But first, let's hear how the advances in rail lines in Spain are making it easier than ever to explore its far-flung cities and countryside. If you're planning to spend some extra time in Spain, consider taking advantage of one of Europe's largest high-speed rail networks and riding the rails through all four corners of the country. With Madrid or Barcelona as a starting point, you can easily access Spain's major cities, all within a few hours of each other. And if you have even more time, consider the scenic routes on a tourist train that winds through the mountains or breezes along the coast. We're taking Spain by train with guides Francisco Glaria and William Rosenden. Francisco and William, thanks for joining us right here in our studio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Rick. Nice to be here.
Yeah. Give me a little background. Francisco, where do you live and how long have you been guiding? And tell us about your experience on the trains in Spain.
So I'm from Spain. I live in Pamplona, all the way in the north of Spain, the Basque Country. And I've been guiding for almost 20 years now, traveling trains from the cradle. I mean, Spain, as you were saying, the Spanish railroads are amazing. So it's probably the easiest way to move around Spain.
Nice. And William, what's your story?
Well, I live in the northwest, close to you, Rick, just an hour down the street, and I've been guiding for 11 years and have been going back and forth to Spain for the last 40 years and took the Spanish trains 40 years ago when it took 21 hours.
That's my transition point right there. 40 years ago, I remember the trains in Spain. I remember, you probably do too, Francisco, when there was a different gauge in France and in Spain. And you had to, in the middle of the night, you're taking the train from Paris to Madrid and you had to get out and then walk over there and get a train with a wider carriage or a narrower
exactly.
carriage. What was that? The different, why did Spain have a different gauge?
So for that, we need to go back to history. We need to go back to World War II, Spanish Civil War. It's ending. World War II starts. Franco wants to isolate Spain. So at that moment, the best way of transportation was by train. So he decided to move the size of our railroads. So that way, he would make everybody come out in the border so he could control everybody coming in and everybody coming out.
You know what I got to say about that? Damn those fascists.
Those fascists are not nice people.
Damn those fascists. You're going to make me get up in the middle. I didn't know that. And so many times I got up in the middle of the night so Franco could make me get out of the train
and
know who's on that train and then show your passport and get on a different train. So it's physically impossible for the train that came from France to continue into Spain.
That was the idea.
Different gauge.
That was the idea, to isolate the country.
I'm glad the good guys won.
I got to Spain only 9 years after Franco's death.
Yeah.
And, of course, then we had border control as well.
Oh, yeah.
So you not only had to get off at Irún, at the French-Spanish border, but then you had to go through the border
patrol. Hende.
Andaye, right?
Andaye, yeah. I remember, Irún. I did never, yeah. That's funny
because Irún.
When you said Irún, then I'm thinking there's two border towns.
Correct.
And you do all the, you think, great, I got through the border. No, you just got through the first border.
Yes.
Then you go through no man's land and then you get the second border.
And then you go through
border.
Irún in Spain. So you had all of that.
Francisco, tell me about the AVE because it's something Spain can really be proud of.
So in 1992, when we had the Olympic Games in Barcelona, we had this World Fair in Seville. It was a big, big year to show the world that we made it. And one of the big improvements was the AVE, the high-speed train. It was a way to show off that, hey, we can do it as well. And this is when we made this first line from Madrid all the way to Seville. And in less than 3 hours, you go from the capital all the way to the south of Spain. It was like, wow.
I remember Seville suddenly is a conceivable day trip from Madrid.
For us, that was mind-blowing. It was like impossible. You cannot do it.
And for the tourist, the old backpacking tourist, I bet you remember that one.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And if you had a little extra money in the 80s, you would, or the 70s, you would take the Talgo.
The Talgo,
remember
that's
the
right.
Talgo?
Yeah.
So the Talgo is the ritzy train.
The ritzy version on could, the bullet track.
Instead of Madrid to Granada in 12 hours, all of a sudden you were to 6 hours.
Yeah. Isn't that something? And now the train is so good that I remember I used to fly from Madrid to Barcelona, but I think most people these days would simply take the train.
You take the train. You go from city center to city center in less than 3 hours. Easy, comfortable. It's much more reliable than the plane. It's perfect.
What's your experience?
And they have great jamón sandwiches. Bocadillos de jamón.
Oh, is
on the
that
train,
right?
So you can get
there. You go.
Jamón ibérico.
That's my ritual welcome to
right?
Spain.
Your nice glass of wine and your jamón ibérico, and you're good to go.
This is fantastic. This is Travel Freak Steves. We're talking with Francisco Glaria, and we're talking with William Rosenden, two wonderful guides from Spain, and we are frankly raving about the trains in Spain. Okay, so let's just talk about how people, when they're thinking about their itinerary. What is some good strategies with the train? Now, there are cases when you want to fly. Where's a case in Iberia where you would likely fly on a discount airline than take the train?
I would say often from Madrid to Santiago de Compostela.
That's what I was thinking. I've taken Wizz Air to Santiago de Compostela.
Yeah, or Ryanair would go back and forth. Yeah. Now you can take the AVE.
To Santiago.
To Santiago.
Yes, it is something that open in 2023.
Oh,
it's good. A new line, and everybody's like raving about it. But it really has connected finally the northwest of Spain with the city center.
What about Lisbon?
Coming.
It's coming. That's
it's
what
coming.
I learned.
Yeah, this is the big new announcement.
It's so obvious. Madrid, Barcelona, three hours or whatever, every hour of train. But Barcelona, Lisbon, it's almost like you guys don't like each other.
They have finally reached an agreement. So they say that they're going to now have a high-speed rail between the two capital
that's what
cities. Yeah,
that's the buzz in Portugal. I was just there.
Yes.
And it's not good for the Portuguese and the Spanish airlines, I suppose, but it's good for the travelers. And now you'll have that AVE convenience. One thing I like about it is the view. I was just marveling at the view from Madrid to Barcelona. I just could not stop looking out the window. It was dramatical.
It's one of those views you get to see the plains, all the plateau of Spain, and then you get closer to Barcelona, you get to see, it's a beautiful ride.
There's just something really magical about watching the Spanish countryside, like I have mentioned before, going by while you're having a glass of Rioja.
Yeah.
How can you beat that?
Spring for a nice glass of wine.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we are enjoying the view. We're having a nice ham sandwich with a beautiful glass of red wine. Tell me about some particularly scenic train rides that you would want to look out the window. And maybe not even AVE trains. Are there slower trains, like through the mountains or along the coast?
I have to laugh. The train from Madrid to Pamplona, which is Francisco's home, is a slow, bumpy train.
Is that right?
Where you almost
Thank you so much for publicity in my city.
You almost need a chiropractic adjustment when you're done with that train ride.
I understand that comes with the train ride.
It truly does feel like you're going back in time.
Really?
And they haven't quite, as far as Pamplona is an incredible city. They still have not improved the railroad.
Now, why would that be? Does it have something to do with what's your state called?
Navarra. Oh, God. Here we go. Yes, unfortunately, it has to do with politics.
I'm sure it does.
And the Basque separatism. And are we Spanish? Are we no Spanish? Do we deserve something from Spain? So that's the big problem. Are we Spanish? Are we not Spanish? We're Basque. We're part of Spain. I'm very proud to be Spanish. But not the politicians.
So you're Spanish, but not Spanish enough to have an AVE.
There we go.
And the Catalonians are.
And the Catalonians are the two big cities, Madrid and Barcelona. So
They have to do that.
They have to.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking trains in Spain with Francisco Glaria and William Rosenden. So if you look at just the times, I'm just going to rip off some times here. From Madrid, that's the hub. Most of us will fly into Madrid. In under 3 hours, you can be in Sevilla. In 1 hour, you can be to Toledo. In 3 hours, you can be in Barcelona without flying. You can be in Granada in 3.5 hours. You can be in Segovia in about an hour. I love the thought of just hopping on a train. What are some of the tips that we can be more comfortable taking full advantage of this train system?
It's actually gotten a little bit more complicated because now we have low-cost lines that have come into the system, right? So we have an Italian line that has come into the system. We have a French line that has come into the system. And now we continue to have the AVE. So there's competition.
And are these other trains slower and cheaper?
No, they are the same.
The same.
Some of them, the interiors are different. Yeah. Some of them are a little bit more luxurious.
It's competition.
It's competition. And a lot of these lines leave at the same time. So you could be in Madrid wanting to go to Barcelona, and you have a ticket on what's called Ouigo.
Yeah.
It's the French line. And do not ask somebody from AVE for advice.
You know, this is the frustration in England and in many places around Europe. Yeah. Is it used to be the national train line, and now you've got all these competing little companies. And as you said, they have no incentive in helping you find your correct train.
Correct. And to buy the tickets, for me, I go to Trainline. It's a little bit easier. I find that the Renfe ticket website is a little bit more cumbersome. One of the things that I think is happening now is that with so many folks going to Europe now, they're getting sold out quickly.
Yeah, book in advance. And it's cheaper to book in advance because there's got a lot of perfect price discrimination going on with trains all over Europe. Let's finish off just with a kind of a moment, just a Spanish moment that has something to do with the trains. What's a moment, William, that you've had that you just thought, I wish everybody could experience this?
I have to say one of the most special moments is having my tour members on the train, feeling accomplished to get 28 tour members who are so anxious to get to Madrid, the next part of the tour, and I get everybody on the train and we're celebrating and people are taking out their snacks and their food and they're having a picnic on the train and everybody's calm and it's a beautiful moment.
Calm on the train. I love
it. It really is a lovely
And as a tour
time.
Guide to have those
Absolutely.
People having a good, the
I love
smiles
that.
Will show what how good of a job you're doing. And Francisco, what's a moment that you'd like to share with travelers?
To me, I think it's a little bit more romantic. There's a beautiful, beautiful all-style train that goes all the way in the coast of the northern part of Spain. And if you get there, try to get overnight and sleep overnight on a train, which is one of the most delightful things you can do. The sound, the movement of the track. It's a beautiful, beautiful train going along the coast of Spain.
Along the coast, the northern coast
the
of
northern
Spain.
Coast.
Wow. And it's a long enough ride to be overnight?
It's overnight. And it's beautiful. It's not cheap.
No.
Because it's a little bit upper grade. But
I've never seen anybody close their eyes and smile in a dreamy way when they're talking about how delightful it is to sleep on a train.
It is. I mean, if you're in a couch, it's like...
I was just going to ask you, give me the soundtrack.
It's like... You don't know. It's like you're being rocked.
That's it.
You
did it. You did it.
And you're rocked. It's like, come on, you're in a cradle. Somebody's rocking you. It's perfect.
Well, and Rick, and it's not like the 70s and 80s when the conductor would come in the middle of the night and say, give me your ticket.
You'd be trying to sleep and you'd flip on the lights.
Those days are gone.
And you go, passport. Thank goodness we don't have that anymore. Hey, William and Francisco, thank you so much and happy travels by train in Spain.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Journalists with a keen eye on the world join us next on Travel with Rick Steves. First, Nick Kristoff from The New York Times shares what it was like for him to be an overseas correspondent, reporting from war zones and dangerous assignments. And British writer John Ellich reminds us that the national borders we've inherited today often have hidden stories to reveal about conquests, alliances, follies, and broken treaties that leave their mark on the world for years to come. For the past 40 years, Nicholas Kristof has written for The New York Times as a foreign correspondent, as a bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo, and as a columnist. In his new book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, he provides a candid look at his work, the lessons he's learned, and why good journalism remains so important to our democracy. Nick joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves from his home in Oregon's Willamette Valley to let us stow away with him on a typical day on the road as a foreign correspondent. Nick, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
So you have had an amazing career with the New York Times over 40 years. Can you just give us a quick review of what went on in that 40 years?
Yeah, I started out in New York covering kind of boring stuff. My beat was exchange rates, this kind of thing. And then I was a correspondent in Los Angeles, then a bureau chief in Hong Kong, a bureau chief in Beijing, bureau chief in Japan, and, you know, began to travel the world in that period, then became a editor briefly, and then have been a columnist since 2001, covering, you know, the world again, really every corner of it.
So basically, the first half of the career was for a foreign reporter overseas.
That's correct.
And the last half was opinion columnist. For the first half, you had to report, and for the last half, you've been opining.
That's correct, yeah.
What do you like better?
You know, I do like the opining because I think that often gives me another layer which I can help provide meaning to readers. But I do think that the most important thing of my work, even if I'm an opinion columnist, is the reporting, not just the opinion.
Yeah. And you have a lot to report on in your book. I mean, what a page turner. I don't use that word very often, but your book is a page turner. Maybe it's because it's mostly travel, and I love travel so much, but this is crazy travel. This is extreme travel, what you do, but there's a lot of similarities. And what I would like to do, there's one chapter in your book, Chasing Hope, that's kind of like a day in the life of a foreign correspondent. And I'd love to just take a look at that for our travelers who are listening now. And this is the typical day in the life of you when you're out on the road, not on vacation. First of all, you wake up, and you did this chapter as a kind of a collection of experiences from different places, but generally, there's kind of a soundtrack when you're in a foreign land of when you're waking up. What happens?
Well, that's particularly true in Muslim countries where you hear the call to prayer. And, you know, I lived in Egypt for a year studying Arabic, and I remember the first day or two in my apartment, I just, like, bolted out of bed with the first call to prayer. And then, you know, after I got used to it, I just slept right through it.
Well, it is early. I think the first call to prayer, part of the words is, it's better to pray than to sleep.
And yeah, that's exactly right.
And I believe that Muhammad, before in the days of alarm clocks, Muhammad would say, when you have enough light to distinguish between a dark hair and a white hair on your arm, then it's light enough to get up. So that was the moment. So you got the call to prayer. It's usually one minaret and then a cacophony of minarets, isn't it?
Exactly right.
And then dogs start howling.
That's right. And people start moving, and then, you know, the vehicles start honking, and you kind of give up on sleep.
And then you untangle yourself, you said. What are you tangled up in when you sleep?
Well, I tend to use a sheet sack if I'm concerned about bed bugs. I had a bad encounter with bed bugs in Central African Republic, and I'm still a little traumatized by it. Mm-hmm. So I try to inspect for bed bugs, and then I use a sheet sack to try to reduce the prospect that I'll
And this is a silk
in.
Sleep sack you mentioned.
I'm into that, right.
Because I spent many years as a youth hosteler using sleep sacks because you had to provide your own sack. And does a silk sleep sack really protect you from bed bugs?
Well, it has me. I haven't done a randomized controlled trial, but I don't think a bed bug could get through it.
Right.
And
that's good.
It's very, very light. You know, it means that you don't have other things next to your body, next to your clothes that might take it home.
Then you don't need to complain about dirty sheets. You got your own.
That's exactly right. And they're a silk sheet sack is just so light.
Yeah.
You know, it's 2 or 3 ounces. So it's easy.
And then, of course, a mosquito net.
And then a mosquito, a bed net. I've had malaria a couple of times. You don't want to get it. And the malarial mosquitoes primarily bite just at night. And so if you can protect yourself at night, then that makes all the difference. You want to ideally have a bed net that has been treated with insecticide that reduces the likelihood that the mosquitoes will come. And also, if I'm enveloped in a sheet sack and maybe a bed net, then rats are a little less likely to come, you know, like crawling over me. And there's nothing more disgusting than being woken up by a rat crawling over you in the middle of the night.
No, I would imagine, although I've never had that that delight. Wow. Nicholas Kristof has won Pulitzer Prizes for his columns on Darfur and for his coverage of China. He's with us today on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about his career as a reporter and foreign correspondent, which he writes about in his book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. You can also find out about his family farm in Oregon's Willamette Valley, where they're making cider and wine, at kristoffarms.com. Okay, so you're untangled from your mosquito net and your bed sheet, and the crows and the call to prayer has woken you up. You got to brush your teeth.
Yeah, you always have clean water with you. If you don't, then you want to make sure you bring some, you know, iodine tablets or some way to purify water. You certainly don't want to get sick in the middle of nowhere.
You mentioned you went to sleep with your headlamp on because generally you'd have no electricity.
Yeah, my headlamp, not on in the sense of the light being on, but it's on my forehead so that if I need to wake up, there's some crisis, then, you know, I'm not fumbling around trying to find it. So I just leave my headlamp on my forehead when I sleep.
on the theory that there's probably going to be no electricity there.
So if there's no electricity and no decent water and worry of rats crawling over you at night, I bet it's tough to get a good cup of coffee right out of bed.
You know, I don't have a lot of other foibles. I am an addict for coffee. I believe deeply in a cup of coffee in the morning. And so the night before, I try to figure out if there's going to be some coffee somewhere. And sometimes, you know, Ethiopia and Eritrea both have amazing coffee, even in, you know, in small places. Mm-hmm. But that is often not true. Because of the risk of not getting a good cup of coffee, I do take chocolate-covered coffee beans with me on trips. And they do make something of a substitute if you are a coffee addict.
So that gives you the same hit that a cup of coffee does.
Yeah, it helps wake me up in the morning.
Nice. Well, that's actually good to know. And then I can't really start the day without a shower. I don't know how people do. In a lot of war-torn places and sad corners of this planet, you know, there's just no running water. And oftentimes where you're working, there'd be no water. What generally would you do for a shower?
you don't take one. You know, sometimes every 2 or 3 days, maybe there'll be some place where you can pour water over your, there'll be a kind of a bucket shower kind of thing where you just pour water over yourself. You know, a little bit nervous about what might be in that water, parasites, but one has to be clean. So I do that, but that's almost never a morning thing, partly because the water is probably going to be cold. It tends to be a late afternoon thing for me.
Is that usually like a big barrel of water with a scoop in it that you just can kind of douse yourself out? So
that's
for a lot
exactly
of people,
right.
That's their shower, and it's a couple times a week or something. And then you mentioned you don't get the day started without emailing home. What was the purpose of that?
So that's partly for security. So I want people at the New York Times to know that I am starting out from this location. I plan to go to that location. Mm-hmm. And nowadays we're getting much better at security and we can have devices that provide a track for us. You know, we can be located more easily. Security is something I take very seriously, partly because I've lost too many friends along the way. And if I try to have two vehicles so that if one, you know, runs into trouble and you're not lost in the middle of nowhere, I try to make sure I have lots of water. If we do have two vehicles, we have a walkie-talkie back and forth so that if the first one goes out to a checkpoint and the second one hangs back so that if something bad were to happen at the checkpoint, the second one can leave and can report what happened. And it also, I think, dissuades people at a checkpoint from, you know, killing or robbing somebody if they know that there's a witness in another vehicle that can escape.
Wow, this is Travel with Rick Steves. We're learning some extreme travel tips from Nicholas Kristof. He's just released a memoir about his life as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. His new book's called Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, and Nick gives vivid accounts of lessons learned from traveling into major conflict zones and into nearly every corner of this world. His opinion column appears twice a week in the New York Times. Okay, Nick, so you're ready to head off to work, and one thing I noticed is you take your luggage with you, even if you're not checking out of the hotel.
That's right. And now, I mean, that's partly because I just never know quite what will happen on the road. And, you know, I also want to have stuff with me. This is assuming that I've got a vehicle that I control and that I'm taking for the day. But, you know, it might be that I get stuck. One time in Congo, I got stuck in a diamond mine overnight. And it would have been nice to have my gear with me. So I try to take as much as I can.
Even though you're packing very light, you do take a light blazer along.
Yeah, I mean, that's really because there is some chance I'll end up interviewing the president or prime minister. And so I try to have, you know, some clothes that are just, that won't get me totally driven out of the presidential palace.
Right.
So that's, you know, I don't take a tie, but I have some shirt that can be mildly, mildly passable, and usually some khakis and some shoes that aren't too disreputable.
But otherwise clothes that are security minded, zippers, hidden pockets, and this kind of thing.
Correct. Yeah, I love some of these travel clothes that that have like hidden pockets. And I also carry, so I have a decoy wallet. So if somebody somebody asks for tries to rob me in my wallet, I can, you know, hand something over with just, you know, a small amount of money. But then I have usually my money and my passport in a little pouch that
connects to my belt and then goes inside my pants. And, you know, I've had robbers, like, they take off my shoes and socks and, you know, search me, but they've never discovered that pouch.
You probably have a need for lots of just cash. Do you bring a lot of cash when you travel?
I do, because, of course, you know, credit cards aren't accepted, and you often have to pay, you know, very large sums, you know, to hire a vehicle. Hotels tend to be very cheap, but vehicles and fuel tend to be often quite expensive.
Well,
and,
plus, you know, there's other reasons. I mean, you wrote in your book, Chasing Hope, about bumping into somebody in Afghanistan, and what you had to bring them $60,000 in cash.
Yeah. So when the war was beginning in Afghanistan, I flew to Kabul. This is in 2001, right after Kabul had fallen from the Taliban. And so there were reporters coming in from around the country with the resistance, and they had run out of cash. And so I flew into Kabul on a UN flight with $60,000 in cash and a bunch of cameras and satellite phones for all of them. You know, I arrived at the airport, and it was I didn't know how to get from the airport safely to the New York Times bureau that had just been created. And I remember bargaining for ages to make it seem as if I was just incredibly impoverished and couldn't afford, you know, $50 to get into Kabul, because I didn't want to be seen to be, you know, worth robbing.
The last thing I want to talk about in your light packing bag is a tourniquet.
Yeah, that's because I've had friends who've been shot or injured in a limb and have bled out. And so a tourniquet is light. And if you are shot, or, you know, it could be a vehicle accident or something, but if you can apply that tourniquet or have somebody else know that it's in your bag and can apply it, that is truly life-saving.
So that could have saved their life, having a tourniquet and knowing how to use it.
Absolutely.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Nicholas Kristof. His new book is Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. And we're just reviewing a day in the life of a reporter far away as a foreign correspondent. Nick, as a journalist, there are hotels in conflict zones that are kind of the go-to place for journalists, I understand, right? And I'm always amazed at or impressed by the fact that journalists can gather together in relative safely in a conflict zone if they know which hotel to go to. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there have always been some hotels in Beirut and Somalia, in Haiti, that just build a reputation for making things work for journalists and solving their problems. Khartoum was another place. You know, sometimes it's that they pay off the local gangs to stay away. They will pay the telephone company to make sure that there are phone lines that get through, or telex lines, or internet. And in Beirut, the hotel, the Commodore Hotel, where the journalists stayed, they famously had a parrot that would do this incredible mime of a incoming mortar shell. And it would do this, and everybody would dive for the floor.
Just to get a reaction from the guests.
Yeah. Yeah, but the security is just paramount in those kind of situations, and you want to be absolutely sure that you've staying in a hotel where you're not going to be kidnapped and where you can be safe. And journalists are also pretty good in those situations. And when they're overcrowded and there's no room, then, you know, they open the door and let people sleep on the floor or any other place.
And from that base, you can go out and do your work and know you can come back and hopefully have a shower and a meal and find your luggage. It's so interesting to read about your experience as a foreign correspondent. One thing I really was struck with was how it is people that make your work sparkle, meeting people. And that's a big part of your work, and it involves a lot of people skills. I'd like to just wrap up our conversation with, you wrote about, you got yourself into one situation where you had to say, please, don't slaughter a goat on my account.
Oh, this was in Darfur, and I was reporting there in Sudan, and I don't eat meat. I'm a vegetarian. And, you know, the problem is you arrive in some poor village and the village is kind of honored by your arrival and they feel the need to welcome you and give you gifts and feed you and to, you know, slaughter a goat. And they couldn't afford a goat. Right. And so, you know, it would have been worse if they had, because then I would have felt some obligation to eat, eat it when I'm a vegetarian. You know, so I was like begging them, no, don't. And so instead they gave me some fufu, the local grain staple. Yeah. And so I solemnly ate that, wondering if it was going to make me sick, but it didn't. Yeah. And it was, you know, just, again, a tribute to the hospitality that people have shown me all over the world and often, you know, taken risks to keep me alive during my reporting.
Yeah. Oh, that is such a powerful, deep-seated need, is to be hospitable to foreign guests. I mean, in Latin America, this mi casa, su casa, my house is your casa, your house is taken literally from people who are very, very poor. And of course, across Islam, you know, devout Muslims really do believe that a guest from far away is a gift from God, and they treat us as such. Such a great opportunity you have to humanize this world through your work. And thank you for the passion you've brought to this.
Thank you. No, it's been great. And I, you know, you and I are both kind of in the travel business, and the opportunities you have to meet amazing people and see the world and learn from other countries about our own is really powerful.
Oh, yeah. It's just so important to get out there. You don't need to, you know, go to bed with your headlamp on, but you do get out of your comfort zone and see all these opportunities to learn as a way to realize that we got to learn to live together on this great planet. Nicholas Kristof, thanks for your work. Best wishes with your book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, and happy travels.
Great to be with you, Rick.
You can read what Nick Kristof has to say about the world twice a week in the New York Times. And we have links to his earlier appearances with us in our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. A British journalist joins us next. John Ehlich writes with an eye on our cities and how we organize our world. He's looked at why today's national borders look the way they do and writes about it in A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. He tells us about it next on Travel with Rick Steves. Ever since I was a kid, I've gazed at my globe or paged through my world atlas and imagined how every borderline does more than just define countries. It tells a story. Who made that line? Who won? Who lost? How clean is the division? How did these lines change over the centuries? Journalist John Ehlich has been exploring the complicated way borders have been shaping human history and doing so for as long as we've been around to draw these borders. He's written a fun-to-read book called A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. It tells the stories behind some of the world's best-known borders and some of its most controversial ones. He joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to uncover how these invisible lines have influenced our history and how they shape the world we live in today. John, welcome.
Hello, Rick. Thank you very much for having me.
What a fun topic to delve into. And you write that today's maps divide the land masses of planet Earth into roughly 193 discrete bits, most of which are less than 2 centuries old. What a fun book to focus on. Now, how did you get interested in borders as a way to delve into history?
Oh, there are all sorts of answers to that question. It's kind of a lot of different things came together. Part of it was that I was looking at a map of the world, as you were saying, you have yourself, and it sort of just hit me in a blinding flash one day how these things we call countries are completely manufactured. You know, at some point, somebody had to make them up, and every one of them has borders that could have gone elsewhere. And I was just thinking, like, why do we have the countries we have? Why do we have the lines on the map where they are? And also, as I was thinking about this, we were here in the UK, we were coming towards the crescendo of the Brexit process, of leaving the European Union, which was changing the way Britain's borders functioned. So it kind of felt like a very contemporary topic as well.
That's interesting. That is, as a Brit, I think having lived through the whole Brexit thing, it does get you thinking about borders. Now, as a traveler, I can think of some very memorable border crossings, and I'm kind of sad that these days more people fly from big city to big city and they don't even have that experience to cross a border. Can you think of any particular border crossings that you've found memorable or interesting?
I have to say, tragically few. As you suggest yourself, most of the time I've crossed a border, it's been in an aeroplane or occasionally in a train. Like, yeah. I think one of the sort of greatest sort of engineering achievements the human race has ever managed is the Channel Tunnel, which links England to France. And the fact you can get on a train in London and get off it in Paris or Brussels or even at certain times of the year in the Mediterranean.
And John, I got a hunch you're young enough not to remember being sniffed by dogs as you went from England to France. Now, the beautiful thing about ideally in the modern age within countries that work well together is borders become less of a deal. You hardly know when you're going through a border. When I started traveling, getting your passport stamped was part of the fun. And now it's almost hard to find a place to stamp your passport when you're crossing around in Europe. So borders are getting less of a thing. And we kind of forget that they do matter.
They do. But also one of the reasons, as I was saying, one of the reasons that this topic was felt so current to me is because my country had made the slightly unexpected decision to make its borders more difficult to cross.
Yeah, that's going backwards to me as a traveler.
Exactly. Like I've got very used to the fact that I had a legal right to live in any one of 27 other European countries. And after a democratic vote here in 2016, that has changed. I no longer have that right.
So, John, do you think when you think of borders, generally we're talking about political borders? There's other ways to think of a map and borders, aren't there? There's linguistic borders, ethnic borders, religious boundaries, free trade zones. How do these relate to each other and what do they have to do with modern borders today?
So one of the questions that I keep coming at in the book is like the relationship between physical geography and national identity. And I kind of came to the conclusion that actually while these two things do sort of influence each other, it's kind of irresolvable as to kind of which came first. But I think you can probably say that about all these different kinds of borders as well. Like, so you'll get in a continent like Europe, you will get different linguistic groups that will often be divided by natural features like mountain ranges or major rivers or so on. But they're not always. You also get countries like Switzerland, which makes no sense whatsoever. If you kind of think of the nation state as being a sort of construct of a group of people that generally have a similar language, often a similar culture. Switzerland is kind of a challenge to that whole conception of what a nation is because it's 3.5 different language groups. And the main thing that's held the Swiss together through 800 years of history is not wanting to be part of any of the countries that surround it.
John Ehlich writes occasional columns for The New Statesman. He's also a guest commentator on BBC Radio from time to time and writes about politics, urbanism, and social issues for a number of newspapers and online magazines. John's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about some of the surprises he's uncovered in his book, A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. John's also written The Compendium of Not Quite Everything. He has a subscription column on Substack and shares more on his website, johnellege.wordpress.com. That's spelled JONELLEDGE. Now, if you look at a border in a troubled part of the world that is a straight line, you can look at that straight line and think that's the root of the troubles we read about in the newspaper. Talk about that in the context of the Middle East with the straight lines on the borders that separate Syria and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and so on. Those were made not by locals who understood the ethnic realities, but by colonial powers, European powers, France and Britain, right?
Yeah, so generally speaking, if you're ever looking at a map and you see a straight line, it is a sign that an imperial power at some point has been dividing territory up with one of its rivals, probably in a conference room many hundreds of miles away from the place you're looking at. So the most famous straight line in the Middle East, the line in the sand, was the result of an agreement called Sykes-Picot, which was signed between the British and the French in the middle of World War One. Where basically the Ottoman Empire, which had controlled that part of the world for many centuries at that point, was widely agreed to be on its last legs.
Okay, so let me do this in a nice British accent, which you'd be better at than me. But in 1915, these fancy aristocrats and diplomats in London or in Paris got together talking about the Middle East, talking about Syria and talking about Iraq. And they said, I should like to draw a line
from the E in Acker to the last K in Kirkuk. And then they would draw that line. They were looking at some goofy map, and they drew it from one word to the other on the map. And to this day, that line survives, and it's caused a lot of bloodshed.
Yeah, I mean, in 2014, 2015, ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the sort of upstart Islamic fundamentalist movement, was trying to erase that line, trying to create a new Islamic fundamentalist state that would take territory from both of those countries.
And much as we didn't like what ISIS was doing, to be honest, if you look at the state they created for a little while, the Islamic State, IS, that's the state that should have been recognized 100 years ago when they drew that line in the sand, I would think.
Should is a very difficult word because
but it represents
yes.
the ethnic and the religious passions of the people there, isn't it? Doesn't it? More.
Yes, arguably. I mean, I'm going to be honest. We're dancing on the edge of my knowledge here, so I don't want to come out and say I think ISIS was correct because I don't have that level of granular knowledge about that region. But one of the problems you run into again and again in a lot of world history is that actually you can't neatly separate different ethnic or linguistic groups into different geographical regions. Like one of the themes of 19th and 20th century European history is people effectively being ethnically cleansed to create these kind of pure nation states that are just like one ethnicity. When in fact, if you look at much of Central and Eastern Europe, it never worked like that. It's an attempt to impose a particular a concept, the nation state, idea that everyone in the geographical region should share an identity onto a part of the world that hasn't historically worked like that. And I think there are elements of that in the Middle East as well, which is why I'm saying, the line in the sand was act of imperialism. It was two European imperial powers dividing up a part of the world they had no particular business being in between them. But nonetheless, I don't think you can necessarily say that the people on either side of the line should, it's as simple as they should be one nation. It's more complicated than that. It generally is.
John, we can look all over the globe and find examples of this. Of course, Spain and Portugal decided, back in 1494, to draw a longitudinal line, a north-south line, and it said everything east of this line is Portuguese, everything is west is Spanish. Of course, Portugal and Spain don't rule these countries anymore, but Brazil speaks Portuguese, and everything to the west of that line, the other countries, is Spanish to this day.
It's incredible, isn't it? Just imagine two royal families just drew a line down the middle of an ocean and said, right, this side of the world is yours and this side of it is ours. Just like the sheer level of presumption.
Even beyond that, you wrote in your book, I love the way your book is little bite-sized stories. So it's just a delight to read. And you talked about how they actually decided over in Spain and Portugal or whatever, that 370 leagues west of Cape Verde Islands is a longitude line that runs all the way to the South Pole. I don't even know what a league is, and I doubt if I could find Cape Verde Islands in the Atlantic, but 370 leagues west of those islands, that's going to be the line that was just arbitrarily plucked out of the blue, was the line that separates Brazil from the rest of Spanish-speaking South America.
I believe I'm right in saying that a league is roughly 3 miles. It's the distance a man can walk in an hour, although that's obviously harder in the Atlantic Ocean. But one of the incredible things about that line is they didn't really know what it was going to run through. So there is an argument that when these two royal houses drew that line, they didn't realize they were going to be dividing up the continent of South America as well. They may have thought they were just putting it down the middle of an ocean, and it's pure chance that it happened to give this kind of the eastern tip of South America to the Portuguese, which half a millennium later means the large and thriving nation of Brazil still speaks Portuguese to this day.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with John Ehrlich, and his book is A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. John, I think a lot of us forget that there didn't always need to be borders because people were just in tribes that were roaming around, and bully tribes were pushing the meeker tribes to less desirable land and then established where they were. When we look at the map, how can we draw some of those memories of the story of humanity out?
I think that era, it's kind of hard to see on the map. I do think there are a couple of modern nation states that are kind of empires that never fell, which we sort of forget sometimes. But the modern forms of both Russia and China are basically leftover empires from the Golden Age or such things. But if you go back far enough, as you suggest, borders were less necessary because people were more likely to be mobile. People were only settled within the last few thousand years. And also borders functioned differently. And if you look at the borders of the ancient Roman or Chinese empires, they weren't necessarily the hard lines we imagine them to be now. They were more likely to be sort of fuzzy no man's lands where imperial control gradually peters out. So something like Hadrian's Wall in the north of England, which divided the Roman province of Britannia from the wild lands of Caledonia in the north, was probably not a hard border so much as kind of a tripwire so that you could kind of monitor people moving in and out of the empire and tax them rather than it being like, you know, a stop line at the edge of Roman territory. And for most of human history, that is probably how borders functioned because we simply didn't have organized polities all over the planet in the way we do now.
You know, when you mentioned where an empire peters out, that reminded me of crossing from Iran to Afghanistan. I mean, that was probably the most godforsaken piece of real estate I've ever had the privilege of sitting at waiting for somebody to come and check my passport, was this no man's land between the Afghan people and the Iranian people. And it wasn't a river. It wasn't a big wall. It was just, we don't care anymore anything further beyond here, and we don't care anymore anything further beyond there. Where the Iranian and Afghan people, you know, drew the line.
This is a recurring theme in the book as well. Like some of the borders I was looking at, I was trying to get answers about why, for example, this are the European microstates, the four or five very, very tiny independent states that still exist. I was thinking, like, why is Andorra still there? Why is Liechtenstein still there? And often the answer is simply because it is. It's just like a series of historical coincidences that mean nobody ever absorbed it into a bigger state. And that is true so often of lines on maps. It's like you can dig down into it as much as you want, but ultimately you find that a line is where it is because nobody put it somewhere else.
Okay, and then there's the other, almost the opposite, where it's the remnant of a big event. Let's say you've got India, which is a big imperial mess of fighting Hindus and Muslims, and they decide to draw a couple of extra lines, and what do you get?
So, yeah, that was one of the stories I actually found the most difficult to read about and then write about, partly because the partition of India, a lot of people die. There's a lot of ethnic cleansing going on, and it's not so much British imperial action so much as inaction. The British Empire is tired. We have no money after World War II. And so the British Empire pulls out of a couple of imperial possessions at very short notice.
You know, this reminds me of the American pullout of Afghanistan. It was just, we were running out of steam, a lot of heartache, a lot of bloodshed. We're gone. And then it just leaves the people there to sort things out. When the Brits pulled out of their Indian colony, you end up with a lot of dead people in Bangladesh and Pakistan.
Yeah, it's an underrated way in which empires can do damage is not just through imperial aggression, but through imperial disinterest as well. Yeah, no, the story of partition is probably the most violent in the book. I can't remember all the figures, but the death toll is numbered in the millions. It's horrifying.
John, in your book, you wrote, sometimes the borders are fleeting, sometimes they persist for centuries. Some are funny, some are absurd. Some brought forth a death toll that ran into the millions. Boy, oh boy, you've got 47 borders that you have chapters on in your book. Let's wrap up our discussion with just one border that we haven't talked about yet that's particularly interesting or poignant to you.
So one of the stories I found most interesting in the book was one of the most obscure, which is the story of the Ugandan-Sudanese Border Commission of 1913, which, unlike, say, the partition of India or the Korean demilitarized zone, is not something that people tend to think about these days. But it's a story in which two British imperial possessions at the time, they need to work out where the line between them goes. So they get a survey team, half officers from the Sudanese side of the line, half of officers from the Ugandan side of the line. And they're both led by these kind of British army captains. And one of them is a decent sort. He's a very good chap. He wants to do right by the locals. He's very determined to find out exactly where all the local tribal territories are. And his opposite number is just tired and wants to go home. So we have extensive diary entries showing the slow motion collapse of the relationship between these two men as they gradually work their way east towards the Indian Ocean. And eventually the tired guy just gets sick of it and goes home, taking his survey team with him. And the other guy pushes on for a little bit, but he's tired too by now, and everyone's got their legs ripped to shreds by formed scrub, and all the animals are dying of hunger. So he gives up. And if you look at the border on the map of Africa to this day, there is a border that starts out in a very, very detailed, but the further east you go, the kind of more and more sweeping the lines become. And for the last couple of hundred miles, it's just a straight line. And again, it's imperial disinterest, but it's also showing that, you know, even noblesse oblige does tend to end quite badly. And probably we should allow people to make their own borders rather than imposing them from outside.
John Elledge, thanks for writing A Brief History of the World in 47 Borders. And in your book, you reminded us that John Lennon sang about imagining a world with no borders. Can you imagine a world with no borders?
I tragically can't. I mean, one of the reasons I got interested in this topic is because I grew up with Star Trek. I sort of imagined we were moving to like one world government and that the European Union was a step on that road. And given events of the last decade of world history, I feel much less certain that that is the direction of travel. I think nation states and borders might be with us for the long term.
Hang on to your passport and get ready to deal with customs if you're going to see the world. Thanks, John, for your book. And what a great topic to delve into.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Kasmara Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Look at Rick's checklist for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum that you'll find at ricksteves.com. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, Rick Steves here. In 1978, I was a 23-year-old piano teacher dreaming of trekking the fabled hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. With my buddy Gene, we booked the tickets, packed our rucksacks, and set out on the adventure of a lifetime. My new book, On the Hippie Trail, features my journal and vivid photos from that coming-of-age trip. Squeeze into rickshaws, sail the sacred Ganges, and look into the eyes of the Virgin Goddess as you stow away with me on the legendary hippie trail. My book, On the Hippie Trail, is available wherever books are sold.